The titles of our magazines reflect our hearts, don't they? Better Homes and Gardens, Money Magazine, Fortune, Success, People. We don't necessarily want to be someone else, but certainly everyone has that desire inside to live the life of the rich and famous, to enjoy that lifestyle, to be noteworthy enough to make the cover of People, or at least know someone who does. We want something really exciting, fulfilling, significant, fun, big for our lives. We want to be successful. And oftentimes, we fail to recognize that, you know, the life that we're living is the one that we have. This is it. You are who you are. With all your limitations and with all of your skills, you are who you are, and the life that you're in, guess what? It's your life. Sometimes trying to or desiring or want to be something different gives us this feeling that, you know, I'm going to get there, I'm going to move on, I'm going to be, or I'm going to do, but oftentimes we fail to actually experience and live and enjoy what we have. In studying the life of David, we studied somebody who was significant. I mean, let's face it, the guy's a king, he's got money, he's got fame, he's good looking, he's got everything, and yet David still lives within the limitations of who he is and what's been given to him. And so when we come to the end of our series, I want to stop and punctuate one more time the reason why we've spent all this time, 17 weeks, looking at the life of David. Because we each have a sphere of influence, a kingdom, a world in which we live, and within that world, we have to make a decision how we're going to do what we're going to do. In fact, we defined our kingdom, our sphere of influence, that's which, what we have control over, that what we influence, what our resources give us. That's our world. That's your world. This is your place. What are you going to do with it? Which brings us to the definition of king work. King work is what you do inside your sphere of influence, how you operate. Do you operate according to God's power and God's principles, or do you have another agenda? But you have your sphere of influence, what you're going to do, and what I don't want you to do is fail to recognize that you have limited time to live it out. You're working within the framework of some limitations. And the framework of those limitations begins at birth and ends at that terrible, awful, ugly, nasty, scary word called death. You're terminal. I'm terminal. There's a time period. And when we come to the end of the life of David, we are reminded very poignantly that life ends. And within that framework, we can begin to find meaning for the life in which we live. So I want you to turn to the end of David's life. We see it in the book of 1 Kings chapter 2. The end of David's life, 1 Kings chapter 2. And there's going to be two lessons that we're going to learn this morning. And then I have three questions to ask you. And they all relate to this horrible topic of death, which in some ways, embracing it, becomes one of the most enlightening and most wonderful topics that we could ever discuss, because it gives us some incredible insight and some incredible freedom. The first lesson that we're going to learn about death is that death is a testimony to our limitations. Death is a testimony to our limitations. And I'm going to point out to you in a few minutes why that's so important to be successful in life. I want you to see what David says in 1 Kings chapter 2, starting in verse 1. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. In verse 2 it says, I am about to go the way of all the earth. That's a very interesting statement, isn't it? Now here's the king who had it his way most of the time, but he makes this incredibly powerful, poignant statement that's very, very striking. He says, I am about to go the way of all the earth. In other words, there's one universal truth that's true for every single person. regardless of where you come from, regardless of where you've been, regardless of who you are, regardless of what you've done, there's one singular truth for every human being. Death bats 1,000%, never misses. I am about to go the way of all the earth. All of a sudden, we see David not as the king, not as the conqueror, not as the giant killer. We see David as human, normal, common, average. I'm about to go the way of all the earth. So he gives a charge to Solomon, and we see his death in verse 10. It says, then David rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Has a city named after him, but it doesn't give him the ability to conquer death. Even with a city named after him. He was buried in the city of David, and he reigned for 40 years in Israel, 7 years in Hebron, and 33 years in Jerusalem, king for 40 years, and yet he still dies. He comes to the end of his life. His life is terminal. It's over. He's dead, just like everyone else. No technology changes that, may prolong it, but we will all die. And understanding that creates a very incredible, a very profound understanding of this moment. Because we're not dead right now, we're alive. But the fact that we're going to die, that there's a limit on our life, informs us that today is very important. Because today will not last forever. We don't have that many of these. And so today is significant. And understanding that I will not live forever means that each and every day of my life is very important. You know what? The older you get, the more critical they become, because the fewer, theoretically, you have. Life has a limit. Do you embrace the limit? The second truth that we learn, or lesson that we learn from the end of David, is a real lesson about people. Very important lesson about people. And that lesson is this, that death is a reminder of people's limitations. Death is a reminder of people's limitations. For you see, there's a story here about David the man that in many ways is kind of an ugly story for a king at the end of his life. Eugene Peterson says it this way in his book on David. He says, death brings out the worst in many people. We'll be treated as a problem to be fixed, or as an opportunity to be seized, or as a responsibility to be carried out and put right, like David. The David story doesn't trade illusion, and it doesn't sentimentalize. When David comes to the end of his life, as we look at the people in his life, we see some very startling things that ought to bring some reality home to us about the way people die. If you'll turn back to chapter 1, starting in the first verse, we see that it says, when King David was old and well advanced in years, he could not keep warm, even when they put covers over him. Now here's this great, incredible warrior that at a very young age, probably 17 years of age, killed the largest, strongest, most powerful man on the battlefield. David, the man that was 600 mighty men, went out and fought battles, kept himself alive in the wilderness, did incredible things. This very, very powerful man cannot generate enough body heat to keep himself warm. There's a problem. He's a problem. He's become a problem for his servants. His failing, feeble health has now become someone's problem. And what are his servants going to do about it? Verse 2 says, so his servant said to him, let us look for a young virgin to attend the king and take care of him. She can lie beside him so that our Lord the king may keep warm. Then they searched throughout Israel for a beautiful girl and found Abishag, a Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The girl was very beautiful. She took care of the king and waited on him, but the king had no intimate relations with her. You say, what in the world is all that about? Well, before the advent of modern medicine, this was a common thing. When you couldn't generate enough body heat, one of the ways that they solved that problem was by getting someone to lay with you that could generate the body heat for you. In fact, all the way up into the Middle Ages, this was a common practice. Here's the bad part. Who would you have hoped would have been available to do this? Now remember, of all the things that David collected in his life, what was one of the things that he collected a lot of? There's no woman around. Why? Gentlemen, think about how you treat your wives. Because they're going to live longer than you. You know that, don't you? Unless you married an older woman. She's going to live at least 7 years longer than you. Long enough to spend all that money that you've been making with the younger man that she's going to marry after you're dead. It's interesting that David comes to the end of his life and they have to go find someone to take care of him. Now, this girl Abishag never says a word in the story, and, you know, supposedly it's an honor to, you know, lay in bed with this king in his old age and keep him warm. And they pick a young virgin girl because this is going to taint her life. This will color her life. Nobody else will really want her, so to speak, as the wife until we find out later on someone wants her because she may be able to provide political power for him. But here's this problem. David can't keep warm, so they've got to find someone, some way, to fix David's problem. And you know what? In old age, you're going to find the same thing of yourself. As you get older, as you get feeble, as your health gets bad, you're going to begin to realize the limitations of the humans around you. As you look at the people around you, they're going to begin to see you as a problem that has to be solved. What are we going to do with Dad's health care? How are we going to take care of him? What are we going to do with Mom? You know, the dementia setting in, the physical ailments. We can't take care of this person anymore. What are we going to do? And if you think that that's not going to happen to you, you better be praying for an early car accident. Because the reality is that it happens. And when it happens, oftentimes it feels like a problem to be fixed. I read recently that just 2 years ago, the World War II veterans were dying at the rate of 1,000 people a day. And now, 2 years later, the World War II veterans are dying at the rate of 1,200 people a day. You know what the problem is? The Pentagon cannot find enough resources to keep up with all the military funerals. And so they're trying to find people that can and are willing to play taps at the World War II veterans' funerals. These men and women who basically saved the modern world have become a problem to be solved. I was talking to a man this week, and he was sharing with me about a visit to a nursing home. And there in the nursing home sits an elderly gentleman who, as you drive around the city of Austin, you see his name on all kinds of billboards. And there he sits by himself with no family that will show up, and he's fed by the attendants there just like everyone else. A problem to be solved. I remember walking into the nursing home the last time I saw my grandmother alive. She was in Michigan, I was in Austin, and I was traveling through, and I just walked in the door one day, stopped in, had 20 minutes going to catch a plane. And I walked in the door, and there she sat in the chair. She couldn't talk. She couldn't move. She couldn't do much. And here I come, and she has no idea I'm coming, unannounced, walk in the door. She hadn't seen me in a year. And I walked in there, and I looked at her, and I'm trying to tell her who I am. And then she finally got it and got this big smile on her face. And I gave her a big hug, and I walked out the door. And that was it. My grandmother, who put days, weeks, and years of time into my life. You know what? When you get old, you're going to find that your failing health becomes a problem for someone to solve. Second thing we see in this David story that's really very sad, and that is when it comes to David's son, this looks like an opportunity to be seized. Verse 5 says, "Now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, 'I will be king.'" Now, he is the fourth son of David, and apparently he's the oldest living son of David. The other three, two of them killed, and the third one we assume is not living. So he's the oldest son, and he says, I'm going to be king. You know, I've waited and waited and waited for Dad to die. The old guy just won't kick the bucket, and I can't wait any longer. Adonijah's probably in his 30s at the time, maybe even older than that. And he can't wait any longer. You know, Dad, come on. Get this over with. I want to be king. So what does he do? Hey, let me read the side verse first. He says, so he got chariots and horses ready and 50 men to run ahead of him. And then here's the side note about David's fathering. His father had never interfered with him by asking, why do you behave as you do? In other words, the kid's a spoiled brat. He's always done whatever he wanted to do. Dad's never stepped in and stopped him before. So why would he think Dad would do anything about it now? So he gets these people to run ahead of him. He was also very handsome and born next after Absalom. I know everybody, you want your kids to be beautiful. You want your men to be handsome. That can really be a curse. Because people in our culture, in our world, who are good looking are treated differently oftentimes, and they're given this feeling that their looks in and of themselves entitle them to something. And you know what? That's a very dangerous place to be. And David's sons are eaten up with this. So he's handsome. He's the king's son. He's going to be king. I'm sick of Dad. I'm going to make this happen. This is an opportunity to be seized. So Adonijah conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abathar the priest, and they gave their support. And so he begins a coup. He gathers together all of the king's sons besides Solomon, who's been slated for the throne, and Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. He gets together Joab, the leader of the military. He gets together one of the two priests, and they go out, and they're going to throw a party, and at that party, this is going to be his coronation. He's going to become king. Can't wait any longer for Dad. I'm going to seize the opportunity. You know, I hear this from time to time from people. You know, there's an inheritance out there that we really, really could use today. We really need the money. We've got lifestyle issues to fund. And yet, you know, Mom and Dad, they just won't seem to go. You know, they're really not doing much with their life. They're really old and feeble. If they could just kind of move on, you say, that just sounds so terrible. That sounds so awful. But you know, it happens. Not only that, but you know, if my boss would just, you know, he needs to, then I could step into my opportunity, moving people out of the way. You know, people are like that. We tend to be like that. Seeing people as an hindrance to be able to get what we want. And David's son sees his dad as standing in his way to get to the throne. Thirdly, we see David's wife, Bathsheba, and she views David as a responsibility to be carried out. Notice what happens. Verse 11, then Nathan, he's the prophet, asked Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king without our Lord David knowing it? Now then, let me advise you how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go into King David and say to him, my lord the king, did you not swear to me your servant, surely Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne. Why then has Adonijah become king? And while you are still talking to the king, I will come in and confirm what you have said. So Bathsheba went in to see the aged king in his room, where Abishag the Shunammite was attending him. Bathsheba bowed low and knelt before the king. See, that's the irony of all scenes. Bathsheba's coming in to make sure that the will gets signed correctly, that you know the issues of who's going to be the next king gets taken care of, that her son ends up where he needs to be, where David promised. But you know what? Abishag, this young woman, is taking care of David's needs, while Bathsheba's taking care of David's business. That's just the way people are. Who's going to be there to take care of your needs? Certainly not David's wife in this case, and there's probably some real good reasons. So anyway, Nathan comes in, They talk to David, they explain what's going on. And finally, David steps up in verse 28. Then the king David said, call in Bathsheba. So she came into the king's presence and stood before him. Then the king took an oath, as surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, I will surely carry out today what I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne in my place. And he goes on and explains what he's going to do. And so he puts Solomon on his mule, which is a sign of kingship, sends him to the brook Gihon, which is the main gathering place for people. It was the main watering place for the city. Sends out the prophet and Nathan and one of the priests, and they go out there and they anoint him and they proclaim him king and they blow the trumpet. They start a processional. The people are making so much noise that Abathar and his group can actually, or excuse me, Adonijah and his group can actually hear the noise, and someone comes and tells them that Solomon's been crowned king, and all the party guests scatter. And basically, Solomon is king, and it's a very humorous story, actually, for a while, until Adonijah tries something else and ends up dying in the process. But the bottom line is that David takes care of business, Solomon's on the throne, David dies, and he's gone. End of story. And now everything's focused on Solomon. So having seen kind of the human background, the human limitations, what people do and do not do, in this situation, let me ask some questions to really challenge us about where we are and what we're going to do with our lives. The first question is this. In my lifetime, in my world, the fact that I will die, I'm asking you the question, am I telling time or building a clock? Am I telling time or building a clock? You say, what in the world are you talking about? Well, one of the books that I read on my study leave was a book called Built to Last, about the 18 visionary companies in the United States that these two guys studied. And one of the things that they talk about in the introduction to the book, or in the opening of the book, is that suppose that you, within your company, had an individual who had the ability to walk outside anytime, day or night, look up at the sky, and immediately tell you exactly what the time was and exactly what the date was on any given time, could do that. You'd say, well, that person would be a phenomenon. I mean, that would be incredible. That would be amazing to have someone that could pinpoint the exact moment in time just by walking outside and looking up at the sky. Suppose you had someone within your company who could build a clock. Now, which one of those two would be more valuable to you? You say, well, I guess that's obvious. You know, even though one of them would be a phenomenon, that person's terminal. When they die, their gift dies with them. But if someone could actually build a clock, then we could tell time long after they're gone. You see my question? My question is, are you living your life in such a way that you are a phenomenon in the moment? Or are you living your life in such a way that you're actually developing something with your life that will go beyond you, that will last longer than you? A few years ago, the movie Dead Poets Society came out, and Robin Williams was inspiring these young people in this movie, Dead Poets Society, with the phrase, carpe diem. Seize or pluck or grasp or grab hold of the day. And the point was, is today's the day in which you're living. Grab the moment. Make the most of every opportunity that you can in the moment. Well, our youth pastor, Bobby Pruitt, in his almost infinite wisdom, not quite that smart, but he's pretty close, he gave a completely different charge to our youth. He didn't tell our youth, carpe diem, seize the moment, seize the day, seize the opportunity. He gave them the statement, carpe aeternitum, seize eternity. There's a significant difference between the two. Because if you seize that which lasts forever, that which is bigger, that which is grander, that which is longer, you know what that means? That means you're also going to carpe diem. You're going to seize the day, but you're going to seize it for a different purpose. You're going to grab a hold of every opportunity you can today, but you're going to do it for the purpose of something that's eternal in nature, rather than only seizing the opportunity based on a grid of personal agenda or selfishness or whatever. And it's amazing to me, as we make the decisions about how we're going to use our day, how we're going to use our time, how we're going to use the people in our lives, the resources that we have, that oftentimes we're all about telling time. You know, the latest job promotion, what's it going to do for me? In this moment, how is this going to further my career? You know, if I marry this person, how is this going to make me happy today? You know, if I make these choices, how is it, this purchase going to fill me up right now in this moment? So much of life is carpe diem, time telling. Seize this hour for personal pleasure, for personal gain, for personal agendas, without having a bigger picture in mind. So what are we doing? We're living moment by moment by moment by moment by moment, simply telling time instead of building a clock. In light of the fact that you will die, what are you doing that will last beyond you? Is there anything? Second question. In light of the fact that I will die, have I allowed my limits to give me freedom, or do I indulge my freedom as if there are no limits? Have I allowed my limits to give me freedom, or do I indulge my freedom as if there are no limits? If you're scratching your head and saying, Sunday morning, it's kind of early, what in the world are you talking about? You know, I guess anytime you talk about death, you got to get real philosophical, right? Kind of gets you past all of the gruesome feelings of all this. I'm not trying to be philosophical. What I'm trying to do is tell you that there is a close correlation between limits and freedom. And if you don't understand limits, you'll never truly be free, because they go hand in hand. Let me give you an example. When a pilot gets behind the controls in the cockpit, of all of the things that a pilot understands his or her limits. They understand that in order to keep this bird from crashing, which would be a limiting factor not only for the pilot, but all the people on board and the airline itself, but they understand that there are certain rules that they must follow. They've got to have the right lift, they've got to have the right speed, they've got to have the right weight, they've got to have all this balance perfectly, and they understand that if they defy any of those limits, that they'll never have the freedom to defy gravity. They work within limits. Musicians understand this. If you can't work with notes on a scale, the limiting factor of the sounds and the intonations of those notes, you'll never make music that actually wants or begs or desires to be heard. Just random noise requires no limits. But if you're going to confine yourself to something that's going to be beautiful, you've got to have scale. You've got to have meter. You've got to have rhythm. You've got to have tonal quality. You see, within those limits, there's an incredible freedom to write a Messiah, Handel's Messiah. There's an incredible freedom to make stuff happen that's beautiful. In the same way, for those of you who don't really relate to any of those analogies, suppose that you found yourself in the same plight that most of the defensive backs found themselves in when they were required to guard Michael Irvin. You see, when Michael Irvin, with his incredible jumping ability and his superior height, went out for a pass, there was almost no way to stop him. And those guys who were usually much shorter defensive backs trying to guard him, they had to understand their limits. I'm not as big as him. I'm not as tall as him. I can't jump as high as him. So understanding my limits gives me the freedom to guard him, because I know I've got to run as fast as I can. I can't take my eye off him. I've got to work within my limits to give me the freedom to do what I do well. And that's keep him from catching a pass. Understanding the fact that I have a short period of time on this earth gives me an understanding that there are limits on what I can accomplish. There are limits on what I can experience. There are limits on what I can do. And understanding that I have those limits gives me a freedom to really dive in and pursue something that's important. But when I don't understand that I have a limit, then I think, well, I can just do whatever I want to. Today I can get up, do whatever I want to. Tomorrow I can do whatever I want to. In the relationships that I'm in, I can do whatever I want to. With the people around me, I can do whatever I want to. Nobody can tell me what to do with my body. I can use it however I want to or abuse it however I want to. You see, I can do whatever I want to because I don't have any limits. And when I think that way, I take liberty, I use freedom in a way that actually is destructive to me and the people around me. The question is, do you understand that the fact that you're going to die is an incredibly freeing concept? It frees you to pursue the things that you need to be doing, and it gives you the freedom to be involved in those with all of your heart. Arnold Toynbee, in his book, Man's Concern with Death, writes these words, "Man alone has foreknowledge of his coming death, and possessing this foreknowledge has a chance, if he chooses to take it, of pondering over the strangeness of his destiny. He has at least a possibility of coping with it, since he is endowed with the capacity to think about it in advance and to face it and to deal with it in some way that is worthy of human dignity. The fact that we know it, if we choose to, gives us a chance to face it and deal with it and to live a life that's worth living. The third question I want to ask this morning is, in light of the fact that I will die, have I vested my hope in this life only or in a resurrection to another life? Have I vested my life in this life only or vested my hope in this life only or in a resurrection to another life? Now here's the really hard part to me about David. I don't know if you guys remember back several weeks ago when we were talking about the death of David's arch enemy, Saul. Remember the guy that kept him for 10 years in the wilderness running for his life? The guy that, despite all of David's efforts to prove his loyalty, was bound and determined to kill him? Do you remember what happened when Saul died? What did David do? David wrote a song about Saul and Jonathan, and he made all of the warriors in Judah memorize that song. He memorialized Solomon. Saul. He memorialized Saul, made a big deal out of his death, put his song into writing, made everybody memorize it so that Saul's memory would not pass off the scene. Now, David, on the other hand, has been a good guy, a good king. He's done more good than Saul ever did. He didn't have all these strange and weird ideas that Saul had that drove everybody away from him. You know, David, by and large, did a great job. And yet at his death, what do we see? We see a hired woman laying beside him to keep him warm while everybody else is out taking care of their business. And I don't see even any record in here of a funeral. I don't see anything written to David. I don't see anything like that taking place. I mean, it appears that Saul had a better memorial service than David. And I kind of scratch my head and I wonder, you know, why is that the case? You know, outside of the human reasons, I think there's a bigger reason. You know who David's most famous son is? His name is Jesus Christ, a direct descendant of David. And when Jesus Christ died, there wasn't anybody writing any songs about him. There wasn't even any fanfare whatsoever. Jesus Christ died a horrible death. In fact, when Jesus Christ was hanging on the cross, dying, without the support of any of his friends around. You know, a few of the closest women were there. John was there, but by and large, he was alone. As Jesus is dying on the cross, he reaches back into David's vocabulary, Psalm 22, and he quotes David saying what? My God, why have you forsaken me? In that moment, Jesus and David were connected in death. Forsaken, abandoned, alone. Regardless of all the accomplishments that Jesus had, regardless of all the accomplishments that David had, really pretty much deserted by every single one. Here's the difference between Jesus and David. 3 days later, Jesus Christ rose from the dead, securing David's future. Here's the deal. No matter what you get in this life, no matter how good you do, no matter how many people you impress, no matter what you build, you're going to die. I'm going to die. And we die alone. You don't die hand in hand with someone else. No one goes with you. You die alone. And the question is, what happens after that? Because that's the really big issue. Because in many ways, life begins at death. Jesus Christ died on the cross and he rose again as a payment for the sins of mankind. For those people who put their trust in Jesus Christ, embraced that he died for me, you have the hope of a resurrection to a life eternal. And ultimately, with everything that happened in David's life, none of it was important as what happened the moment after he died, experiencing the resurrection. See, that's the most significant thing. In many ways, we spend so much effort trying to squeeze it out of this life, and many times spend precious little effort thinking about the life to come. So you tick off your 70, 72, 74, 76 years. Let's face it, some are getting pretty close to that. Maybe 80, 85, 100. And then there's this incredible expanse called eternity. And that's where life begins for the Christian. For you today, what are you looking forward to? Are you looking forward to only tomorrow, only the next day, this life? Or do you understand the incredible promise of resurrection in Jesus Christ? The incredible hope. And if you're here today and you say, Tim, I don't have a clue about that. I don't have a hope. I don't know what's going to happen to me after I die. You can have that hope because Jesus offers that hope to you. And I would trust that before today is over, you would talk to me, talk to one of our elders, talk to our prayer team down in the front, talk to the person next to you and say, hey, can you give me some insight into this? Because we would love to take the time to take you through an understanding of what the Bible says so that you can have the hope too, because resurrection is really where life begins. Where's your hope? In this world or in the world to come? Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, in the limitations of our minds and the limitations of our hearts, we acknowledge that what we can immediately experience oftentimes seems like life. And what we have to plan for and work toward and trust and embrace by faith, that seems like fairy tales. Father, I thank you that you are not a fairy tale. That the life of David is a testimony to us to speak loudly about the need to live in a right way that would be looking forward to eternity. Father, I pray that you would teach us to have the courage to embrace eternity in such a way that we would be confident of our hope in you and to live toward that hope. Father, remind us that that is the thing. That's the only thing really worth embracing. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.